Hello, hello. This is Chris, seafarer turned designer.
And this is Carl, nurse turned designer. Welcome to Design Shifters,
a podcast on how people shift to design. Yes, our guest for today is Debbie Dabouet. She is our classmate from Masters in Design. She graduated with a bachelor's degree in psychology, worked in web management and marketing in a tech company before completely shifting into design. Currently a full-time mom who does woodworking. All right, let's get started.
Welcome, Debbie. First of all, thank you for being here. And just for our audience, can you please introduce yourself?
So hi again, everyone. I'm so glad to be here and talking to you guys. I really miss you guys. It's been such a long time talking to you guys. So I'm just gonna tell you guys about how I shifted into design. As Chris mentioned earlier, I graduated with a BA psychology degree. And during that time, actually, when I chose psychology, it was because I was influenced by the job of my mom, which is psychiatry. And you know how it goes with our parents and how it influences our decisions. And after I graduated with psychology, I didn't really have any inkling as to what I also wanted. So I went into the BPO industry, and it was really funny. I applied for Accenture, and they had projects that were open, and the project that I chose was actually web development. And one of the reasons why was because my then boyfriend, who is now my husband, is also a someone from the web industry. And so I thought to myself, that would be very interesting to get into. It would be a great conversation point. So I went into it again. So as you can see, all of my decisions mainly were very much influenced by the people around me. And I had a good, it was very enjoyable. My psychology background was very enjoyable for me. Also, my time with web development, it was also very, although very challenging at first, because there were a lot of things that I needed to learn, but still, I learned a lot. And it was then actually that I got introduced into the creative industry, or design, if you will. During our downtimes, my mentor and my assistant team lead, her name is Eileen Antenor. Hello, Eileen. Hi, Ate Ai. During our downtimes, actually, we would have a lot of downtimes. She would be sending me really, really beautiful websites. She would send me really experiential websites wherein you would just forget where you are and you'd be really drawn into the images, into the sounds, everything. And so it was what actually captured my attention. I never thought of myself as an artsy person, but then during that time, it kind of occurred to me, like, why wasn't I dabbling with any of these things? So during that time, that was what caught my attention. And then ever since then, I don't think I ever turned back. But during that time also, I never really shifted into design. It was just like really a slow walk going into the creative industry. I was just really admiring. I was more of an admirer rather than an active participant. And so, yeah, during that time, actually, my mentor, we got into a business wherein we created wedding invites. And that's what actually made me really realize that I really enjoyed working with my hands, creating beautiful things. And during that time, when I would say design, it was more of an aesthetic kind of design. It wasn't really solving other people's problems, creating products, those kinds of things. But it was really more on the aestheticness, meeting what the needs were of our clients. During the time, of course, brides, angry brides, very, very scary work. And then after that, I went out of Accenture, and then I actually went to school for a while, because it was then when I realized that I really wanted to delve into design. So I didn't really, I actually went to school. It was like a short course in UV. It was more like an intro to design for me. Unfortunately, I didn't finish the whole course. It's a long story, but then it equipped me quite a bit. And then later on, I think that's how I later on we're gonna be talking, and I think you're gonna be asking me questions, and I think it's the story will unfold by itself.
Yeah. I'm really curious, like, because you started in psychology, right? How did you convince the hiring officer, the hiring manager, the team that scrutinized the whole application process? How did you convince them that you are the man, the woman for the job?
Yeah, so it wasn't really hard, because it was just really an opening. So they gave us the choice. We didn't really have that much. We didn't need to convince them or so. But then again, I think it was more of me showing that I was really willing to learn. Like, even if that wasn't my background, I had a background in psychology, and I didn't know any coding. I couldn't understand all of those things. I think it was that I was just really, really I just really wanted to learn. I was very excited to learn these things, mainly because of my boyfriend, as I said earlier. But yeah.
Nice. And aside from those, you know, challenges, like technical challenges, like coding, what other challenges did you face, you know, from that transition from, you know, starting from psychology and moving to another career?
Yeah, one of the things that it wasn't a challenge, it was more like I really enjoyed it, because in psychology, it's everything is so abstract. Like, for example, if you were given a problem, like this person had a problem and then you had to help that person solve it, it was very abstract. You would give solutions to that person and you don't know if it's going to work or if it's not going to work. But then when it came to coding, if you had a problem and then you could solve it with a line of code, and you could see what works, what doesn't work, and then it was very logical. It was very concrete. Not really concrete, like you could touch it, but you know, it was, you could see what would happen compared to psychology. So that was one of the things that I really, really loved. The challenges was I just really had to dive into another part of my intellect. As I said, logical intellect, maybe, because I was using more of my abstract thinking when it came to psychology. And now that I was soft coding, I wouldn't say hard coding, it was very, very shallow coding. I was more into CSS and HTML, not all of those back-end stuff, but now I can't even remember any of them. And then later on, actually, in my stay in Accenture, I got into the image team, wherein that was where my skills got honed on the tools that I use now, which is Photoshop and Adobe. Oh my gosh, maybe it's been too long. I haven't been using it because I've been busy with momming. But yeah, so it was then actually that my skills also in designing, or rather using these tools in design, got also honed because I got into the image team.
Nice. Yeah, I can see how your transition seems to be like that, a flow. You just go with the flow, right? So from psychology, you got a job, then you just fell in love with design, and then you start working on design. So I just want to know, what's your, this probably like an easy question for you, but what are your strategies to like continue improving in the design field? What are your strategies to keep going?
Okay, so I think one of the strategies I've seen worked with me is that I placed myself in a position, or rather I was placed in a position where I was forced to do something. So maybe for me, that really helped me, because I was placed, for example, when I was placed in the image team back in my old job, we had to reach some sort of a quota. We had to clean up so many images in one day, and we had to submit it all in one day and all these things. And so you don't really have any choice, but you just have to focus and just reach the quota. And for me, that really forced me, that placed me in a situation where I needed to level up my skills. So that's one of the strategies that I've really seen to force myself or to put myself in a situation where I get forced to do things.
Yeah, you somehow shine under pressure.
So yeah.
That's really nice, because probably most of the people who's going to be listening to this interview would be also interested in the story of like how you shifted into a design career. And one of those things that would be asked would be, coming from a background that is non-design, how did you handle any, or did you even experience any self-doubt? Like, were you doubting yourself once you moved to a different career or to the design career?
Very much so. Even until now, I think, yes, every day, you know. I think I had this conversation with one of you guys because as Chris mentioned earlier, we're all classmates, we all know that. But all of us in our master's program, actually, maybe, I don't even know who had a degree in design. I think all of us carry a chip in our shoulders, you know, because we're not design graduates. So for me, of course, every day, you know, especially if you're in a situation where you're faced with people who actually graduated with someone with fine arts or someone with, you know, a degree in the creative industry.
Or have work experience, right?
Yes, yes, exactly. And so, you know, we were talking about that imposter syndrome thing. But I realized though, and we were having this conversation also with my husband, that someone who has imposter syndrome is actually a normal thing. And it's actually a good thing because it shows that you actually have self-awareness. Like, you are aware that you are at a certain level. Like, you're not yet there yet. And so, of course, you'd be plagued with self-doubt, especially when you don't have that background. However, I think for all of us, I think that has been the chip on our shoulder that you know, pushes us to excel, pushes us to learn more, pushes us to, you know, challenges us to, you know, to learn, to read more, to upgrade our skills. So yeah, every day I face those things.
And just to follow up on that, how did you handle it? Like, how are you even handling it right now?
Yeah, so I think with self-doubt, how do I handle it? I just have to create things. So when I am faced with that, with doubting myself, I just have to quiet everything down, and then I just have to focus more on my work. And yeah, I was thinking of an answer to this earlier and I really forgot it right now. Now would be a good time to remember it. But yeah, basically, that's what I do. I just stop all these things, especially nowadays when it's really, you know, I have a lot of friends who are designers. I follow a lot of you, and especially when with us creators, we put our self-esteem or our self-worth on what we create. It's really hard to not have any self-doubts when you, especially in the social media, you could see everything, you know, what people are doing right now, especially during the pandemic, how everyone is so productive and how everyone is so, you know, doing all these things. But I guess you just really have to quiet everything down. That's how I deal with it. And if you can see my living room right now, it's a mess because I've been struggling with a lot of self-doubt lately. And so I am creating a lot of stuff. If you want to see my living room,
just a creative mess.
Yeah.
I can see like how you manage self doubt is sort of you turn it as a motivation rather than something that you get stuck on. But yeah, as creatives, we all know that we have this time in our lives that we just get stuck in a rut. We are in this creative block, so to speak. How do you manage that getting stuck?
Okay, getting stuck. Oh, yes, that's also one of the biggest challenges that I have. I remember this memory. I joined this, what would you call it, Chris? You were there. That was the first time I met you. It was like a it's not a hackathon.
Packaging design hackathon-ish, something from
the DIY. Yeah, I don't think it's a hackathon. DIY. Anyway, it's like a designing package designing thon, wherein we would be paired up with small medium enterprise business owners, and we'd be helping them with their packages. And during that time, it was still I didn't have any background in anything. I was just a beginner, really. But I saw it as an opportunity to exercise my skills. And sometimes, you know, sometimes self-doubt, sometimes it goes away. So sometimes you feel really confident, like you can handle this. And so I went into that, and that was the first time I met Chris, and he did such a good job. I think his client was someone who sold shoes, if I'm not wrong.
Yeah.
Do you remember?
Yeah.
My client sold, actually, she sold Japanese products, Japanese dolls, but then she wanted to actually, she had a side project, which she actually wanted me to work on the packaging, because she sold really good, I think it was native products like Roskilios and all those things. So she wanted, and she was from Karkar, so she asked me to create a packaging, and she gave me a lot of concepts. She gave me a lot of themes that she wanted to be integrated into the design, and I was trying to help her, and I at the same time, I was trying to combine all of these things, and I got so paralyzed. I got so, when I think about it right now, I am still so scared to be in that situation again. I was so paralyzed. I was stuck in a rut. And in the end, I never really created anything for her, because, you know, there's this thing also. I think when you're stuck in a rut, it's because you want things to be perfect. So you're kind of paralyzed because you want things to be perfect. At the same time, you don't want to fail. But then sometimes I just realize that sometimes you just have to fail first. So that's been a thing with me. When I'm stuck in a rut, I usually self-talk myself to make a bad thing first. And then making a bad thing, at least I got that out already. And so it helps me have some sort of a momentum, some kind of movement. So yeah, if I'm stuck in a rut, other than, you know, all of these motivations, like how to motivate yourself to actually do something, sometimes I just tell myself to fail first. Do something to fail first.
That is really beautiful. Like being able to accept. Yeah, I mean, being able to accept failure, I think it's already like one step forward to getting unstuck in the rut.
Yeah. Like I also have this friend. She's a fashion designer, and she wanted to start her own swimsuit line, and that's why she was also stuck in a rut, because she just wanted it to be perfect. She just wanted it to succeed, but then she didn't know how to start, and she didn't want it to fail. And so I told her, make a bad swimsuit first. Just make one at least. So yeah.
Who would model that? Debbie would model that.
No, not anymore. Maybe before.
The bad swimsuit.
Yes. I can do that for her. But yeah. Stucking in a rut. How about you guys, though? Am I the only one who's going to share?
This is about you. But anyway. Okay. Yeah, let's
answer that question. For me, if I get stuck in a rut, I would probably, you know, do some walking. You know, stay, move away from that idea first, and then come back, and I just realized, like, okay, or get feedback from other people. Find the people that you really trust their feedback, and then just ask them to give you like their honest, no holds barred feedback. Yeah. How about you, Chris?
Yeah. It actually matters. From time to time, sometimes one works, sometimes one doesn't. Sometimes I like just take a sleep. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. When I come back, I'm still stuck. So it differs from time to time, because yeah, I'm also like doing some writing recently. I'm creating a blog post, but yeah, I always get stuck on that.
I sometimes
this is like my social contract already. I am bound to release the blog in time
soon.
Yeah. When is your deadline?
Ah, possibly within October, but yeah, let's not get into the details. So.
Okay.
Yeah, it matters time to time. Sometimes I take a sleep. Sometimes I just, yeah, like Carl, I take a walk. I do jogging. I do the exercise because there are times when I notice this. Probably this is less personal. When I take an exercise, my blood just flows and I get that adrenaline high that everything just flows with it. So sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. It differs from time to time. So yeah, that's me. Anyway, let's go back to Debbie. I'm really curious. How are you? How did you like integrate your skills in psychology in when you like working in design? What are the skills you employ? How did you like use the skills in psychology and design?
Yeah. So you know what? Whenever I would think about it, whenever I would think about where I am now and what I took up, I would always ask myself if I regretted taking up psychology. And actually, I really don't regret taking up psychology because one of the things that I just realized how psychology helped me in design, because studying a person, like their motives, their behavior, all of these things, actually helps me design better because I know what they are trying to do, what goals they are trying to reach, what emotions they are trying to quell, all of these things. So it made me it's making me a better designer actually. And one of the skills that I got from psychology is actually empathy. I've been really empathetic before I took up psychology, but I think it got a little bit more improved after taking up that degree. And so as I was saying, yeah, I brought that to the table. I could read people better. I could tell if they really are delighted with a specific thing. You know, so it has really helped me in that way. I realize now, because some people would say, oh, you're not practicing psychology. I mean, it's so sayang, you know, all these things. But then I realized how it has really helped designers. And so actually, that's one of the things that I realized, you know, being in the design field, it's really good to be multidisciplinary. It's really an advantage. I didn't lose anything by not taking up a creative degree back in college.
Nice. Yeah, I would 100% agree on that, Deb, because I think for us, like most or all of the classmates we had on our master's degree on design, we were all multidisciplinary, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
We have, you know, attorney Ian, who's a lawyer. You know, you're a psychologist, Chris before, seafarer.
Mm-hmm.
I was a nurse before, you know, some of our classmates were teachers and or like developers also. So that kind of like, and I'm also seeing that trend also wherein because the, you know, industries are expanding, you know, software is eating up other industries. So mm-hmm. when you go into industries that, let's say an industry that is focused on the law or on legal cases, so that's where, you know, a designer but also a lawyer comes into yeah. place, right? So
yeah,
that's really really something that I also like 100% agree that multidisciplinary is an advantage to a designer. Mm-hmm. So in line with this multidisciplinary, you know, background, if someone has, you know, a non-design degree or career before, would you still suggest that they take up design education, whether that would be, you know, formal on a university or online?
Yeah, of course, 100%. I would still push that person to take up a design course or design anything just to further his or her knowledge in design, because there are a lot of things already out there which have been well researched, well, for example, like Universal Principles of Design, that book, you know, there's so many things to learn in that book, and I'm sure you can learn it through reading, through going through design education. Yes, but not just because I would push someone to pursue a design education, not just because they would learn a lot of stuff, but because they would also be able to network with other designers. And, you know, networking with other designers also helps you in a different way, pushes you to improve on yourself, and it also gives you support. And it's really worth it. Like, for example, gaining you guys, I mean, through the education that I went through with the master's program, it was so much worth it. I mean, you know, so I would not just for the knowledge that you would be gaining, but also for the networking with this fellow students, and networking with your professors, your teachers too, because it's so worth it to have connections in the design industry. You could ask for mentorships, you know, you could ask for all of these things.
I think it really boils down to learning together, growing together with your fellow classmates. So then what are your tips for the upcoming designers who are like wanting to transition to design?
Yeah, so I guess one of the first tips that I would say is to put yourself in a situation that would really force you to do things. So actually, like this, like for example, my journey into the creative industry has really become more niched. Like from back when I was in Accenture in web development, I was into websites, and then I went into graphics, visual design, and then because of that, I went into my wedding invites, and after wedding invites, I went into product design, and after product design, I went into so many other things, and now I'm into interior and woodworking. One of the things that I would say is to list down what are the skills that you need to have so that you could have a competent... you would be competent in that position. List out all the skills, all the knowledge that you need to know, all the books that you need to read, and put yourself in a situation that would force you to do all those things. So, yeah, exactly. And then my next tip would be to fail. Like, just do something. It doesn't matter. Just fail. It's a cliche. I'm sure you've heard of failing forward. But just do something and fail at it. Because failing at it is actually a very good sign that you're pushing yourself into something new. So put yourself in a situation that would force you to do these things. And then second is to do something and fail. Yeah, I think those are my tips.
It's a bit counterintuitive, because your tip number one is like have a strategy for success. And then your tip number two is find ways to fail.
Yeah, because you know, sometimes you just get so overwhelmed with all of the things that you need to do. And so you get, just like me, you get stuck. And I really struggle with paralysis. Like, you know, it's a mind game. So, you know, you just have to tell yourself that it's fine. Like one of the I also dabbled into performing arts, and one of the things that I'd always get nervous whenever we'd be playing as a band before in one of our venues, I'd be so nervous, and then my sister, she would tell me, you know what, just think that no one's listening to you, no one really cares. And so that would really, it's really counterintuitive also. Like, what do you mean? Like, there are people there who went there to listen to the band or whatever. But then, you know, it takes the edge off. So when I say not try to look for ways to fail, but don't be afraid to fail, or rather fail. Just do it and then fail. And so it takes the edge off doing things, of being overwhelmed, because sometimes it's really such a mind game.
embracing failure the way it is. Like, it's okay to fail if ever you fail, right? So it's like embracing it wholeheartedly.
Yeah, just don't have a client.
Yeah, I think that statement has always been, you know, said it again and again, like, you know, in order for us to not be bogged down or paralyzed, we need to not think of, you know, failure, just do it. And when you fail, you know, fail forward, fail fast, and then learn from that failure.
Yeah.
Like a phoenix, rise from the ashes.
Wow.
So now we're since we're talking about all the things that you've dabbled, we just want to point out one thing also, that Debbie is also a pageant contestant. So that's one of those things on her resume. And there are also other things there that we probably didn't dig deeper, but there are probably a lot. And one of those actually, and that is very interesting, is that we've heard that you have a family business that's quite unique.
Yeah.
So can you tell us about that and your plans to, you know, maybe employ your design thinking or, you know, what you learn about design into that business?
So me and my family own a funeral parlor. I'm just not going to disclose the name, but we own a funeral parlor. It's been with us, or rather it's been there for almost more than 14 years. Can you imagine? And, it was my father who actually founded it. Death happens every day. And so, unfortunately, and I don't want it, I never would wish that it would be me or your loved one or my loved one. So, yeah. I've been thinking about that, actually, Carl, for some time now, how to put in my design background into the whole death experience. I've been actually thinking of ways to improve the experience of handling with death. I don't know if this is a weird thing, but...
No, it's a completely relevant topic right now.
Yeah, so from... I've been thinking about it, actually, not just... I've been thinking about it coffin-wise. So we use, of course, wooden coffins. There are different kinds of coffins. So I wanted it to be... Me and my father have had conversations in how to make it more sustainable. So we've been thinking about using other materials other than wood as a alternative to the wooden coffins that we usually use. Other than that is to improve the experience of our clients by making the interiors a little bit better, to make it a little bit more comforting. That hasn't been... I these are just from the top of my head. And another thing which I thought of this, and I think it would be weird. I don't know. Can I ask you guys?
Yeah.
So can I ask you? Can you ask you guys if this is weird?
Sure.
Okay, so I was thinking of, so God forbid someone you love dies. So the final, so someone prepares their bodies, right, to put them inside of the coffin. And so I was thinking of providing the opportunity to the family for a final bathing. Does that sound weird? I can see your face, Carl.
I can, you know, I've been a nurse, and I've also dealt with, you know, people losing their loved ones, patients dying. So I really can see can understand the thought process going into there, because that's your loved one.
Yeah.
And you're taking care of them.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was thinking. Like, you know, especially as someone who, especially now that I'm a mother, of course, oh my goodness, it would break my heart just thinking about death and and my child, God forbid. But if you know, if you lost a loved one, and especially if you're a family member, and I think it's like the final touch, like your way of saying goodbye to the body, just having final closures and taking care of the earthly, you know, earthly remains. Yeah, yeah. So that was just a thought that I had. But I think I actually researched a lot about it. And I don't think culturally we are open to it yet, I think. But then there are a lot of other Asian cultures who actually do it. Because as I said, I did look into this, and other Asian cultures actually, funeral parlor somewhere in, I'm not so sure, but it was Asian. And they actually give that final bathing. When I say final bathing, did I explain it?
Yeah.
It just means to cleanse the body of your loved one when they're preparing his or her body for the, you know, to be in the final place, which is the coffin.
So having that last experience with like putting the remains to rest.
Yeah. But you know, see, that's why I kinda X this idea because before I lost a loved one. It was a family. She was a family friend, and her daughter. Because I also dabbled into makeups, into cosmetics. I used to actually that I also did that during college. I did cosmetics, and people would pay me for it. But yeah, anyway, the daughter of the person who died asked me, "Hey, can you put makeup on Mama?" And I was like, "Okay, sige, because we're family friends, and I would love to do that for you." And then I did that, and I'm never gonna do that again, because it really I realized how it kind of affected me really badly, and so yeah, that's why I X'd that idea out. But since you're asking me on what were my thoughts on how to integrate my design background into our business. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think there's this subtle side of that, subtle value of that. Not the whole experience of like touching, because my sister was like one of the resident doctors during the high peak of the pandemic, and she was like on the emergency room. Mm-hmm. And yeah, she has this iPad with her, and every time the patient is like about to die, about to flatline, they do contact the people, the family, and yeah, she uses her phone, her iPad to like converse with the patient. Mm-hmm. So it's like their last step of like conversing with a patient, and of course the patient doesn't speak. But that last experience is really, really valuable to them, because yeah, that's their last that's their last conversation also. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there's a value. I'm not sure the whole touching and bathing part.
We can
always as designers, we always try to like iterate and test, and but I'm not sure who wants to have a testing.
Yes.
I mean, there's a lot to unpack here, and we are, you know, I actually would love to have another session talking about the death experience from the point of view of a, you know, of the, not the dead, but from the point of view of the people who have lost someone, and then how that experience is, and how as, you know, designers, how we can facilitate to make it into a better experience. And that would be a really good topic for future podcasts.
I think we're wrap up. I don't want to wrap up, but we must. So thank you so much, Debbie. Thank you so much for sharing your story. We had really a lot of fun. And I hope you also enjoy this podcast.
Yeah, it's been such a long time. You know, I haven't had any long conversations with anyone here, especially during the pandemic. So it was such a good chat.
Yeah, thank you, Debbie. And to our listeners, you know, shifting to a design career is scary, but it's not impossible, as what we've learned in this episode. And, you know, Debbie talking about her experience from, you know, from not being a designer into moving into different, just different avenues of jobs until she was, you know, doing design, and she didn't even realize that it was design, and she just loved design as she was going through through that journey. And yeah, so this is the end of the podcast. We hope you enjoy this interview with Debbie and her, you know, scary jump and possible scary business into the beautiful world of design. And Chris?
Yeah, this is Ergo Podcast. Take care and see you in our next episode.